Every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear. Jesus transforms, CT equips. Make a gift to our nonprofit ministry with a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.
This is CT Media.
From Christianity Today, you're listening to Music and Meaning with Charlie Peacock. I have many people to thank for my long, sustainable music career, but perhaps none so significant as Amy Grant and one of our esteemed guests today, Brown Bannister. These two invited me into an album project that would alter the course of all our lives. The album, Heart in Motion by Amy Grant, yielded 5 hit singles and has sold over 5 million copies. More interesting to me is that Amy's vision for a fun, danceable pop record planted a tree that bore the fruit of freedom. A whole generation of musical artists who followed Jesus were set free to dream of serving the church and creating the songs the whole world sings. And they have Amy and Heart in Motion to thank for it. Today, I'm joined by the 3 decorated record producers who helped Amy create her quintessential pop album: Brown Bannister, Michael O'Mardian, and Keith Thomas. Imagine if Midas touched not gold, but vinyl and digital ones and zeros. The result? Well, Brown Bannister's extraordinary discography. A Grammy and Dove Award-winning wizard of the studio, Brown's been shaping the soundscape of popular music for 40-plus years. From Amy Grant to Stephen Curtis Chapman, Sarah Groves to CeCe Winans, he's the go-to vocal whisperer for artists looking to receive the highest form of artistic care. But Brown doesn't just bless what we might think of as Christian or gospel music. He spun gold for country legends like Steve Warner, Paul Overstreet, Vince Gill, and Kenny Rogers, too. In a world of one-hit wonders, Brown is the enduring hymn, blending soul and relationship with a remarkable attention to detail. Whether it's helping to turn Mercy Me into a household name or turning the knobs of one of my own well-known albums, The Secret of Time, Brown's production skill is always next level. In the grand symphony of the music industry, Michael O'Mardian is the maestro everyone wants to score a session with. As of this writing, his recent appearance on Rick Beato's YouTube channel already has nearly 1 million views. This Grammy magnate and one-time producer of the year didn't just hit the scene, he exploded into it. In 1973, Michael arranged and played accordion on Billy Joel's Piano Man. How's that for ubiquitous pop history? And that's just a start. He's worked with everyone from Christopher Cross to Donna Summer, Rod Stewart, Steely Dan, Trisha Yearwood, Vince Gill, Peter Cetera. Remember the yacht rock anthems that had you sailing through the 80s or even the 2020s? Michael was at the helm of several of those. But he's not just about those smooth, catchy hooks. He's a soulful musical encyclopedia and a model for my own eclecticism, shifting from pop to jazz, to country, without ever missing a beat. Have you heard Whitney Houston's debut? Well, that's Michael at work. Scoring films like The Bodyguard? Yep, that's him too. Solo albums like his own White Horse are epic. He's even written and produced music for the Olympics. So what more can I say? He's a giant of a talent and a true gentleman, the producer you call when you want to transcend genres and break records. Literally. Keith Thomas is a producer, songwriter, and audio alchemist that's been crafting sticky, meaningful hits from BB and CC Winans' Heaven to Vanessa Williams' Save the Best for Last that probably had angelic musicians taking notes. Got a genre? Keith's mastered it. Pop, gospel, country, symphonic, you name it. He's turned it into gold, platinum, or whatever comes after platinum, unobtainium. Listen to these credits. James Ingram, Peebo Bryson, Selena, Michael Bolton, Luther Vandross. Keith also produced the song You're Where I Belong, written by Diane Warren and sung by Trisha Yearwood for the movie Stuart Little. So in the 1990s, Keith was as fire could be in pop music, which included a nomination for the coveted Grammy Award Producer of the Year. Not to be bound to any decade, though, Keith has continued to create hits, develop artists, write for film, television, and stage, and joined several other renowned producers and film composers in helping to create a 13,000-song catalog for the Meta Music Initiative. That's Facebook and Instagram. And Amy Grant's Heart in Motion? Well, we're about to get to that, because Keith crafted that sticky earworm, Baby Baby, the song that led the way for the tremendous commercial success of Heart in Motion, and the good fruit 30 years later in 2022, when we watched Amy and music from the album be celebrated by the 45th annual Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Along with Amy, other honorees for lifetime artistic achievements included George Clooney, Gladys Knight, Tanya Leon, and the Irish rock band U2. Before we begin, let me remind you how important it is for you to click some stars and leave a review. This means so much to us. It also sends our podcast aggregators a message that you all are deeply interested in this podcast and eager to support it. So please remember, if you've enjoyed this podcast, click some stars and leave a review. Thank you. Now let's listen in as the four of us, four record producers, all songwriters, 30 plus years later, rewind the story of the making of Amy Grant's 1991 Grammy-nominated album of the year, Heart in Motion. Just to let the audience in on why we're approaching this subject today is that Amy Grant's Heart in Motion is the greatest selling album of all time created out of the Christian music community. And even though we'll all credit so much of that to mainstream pop music, and that's really what we're going to focus on today, we look at Heart in Motion as the peak. It was like everything was moving towards that. There's a whole bunch of theological decisions that were made in the process of getting to the artistic freedom, all kinds of things that we can touch on. The one thing that I want the audience to know immediately before we dive in is to say that this album, Heart in Motion, had five pop smash singles on it that all happened, now wait for it, within a window of 1 year and 3 months.
Really?
Okay, so Keith, Baby Baby, released January 18th, 1991. The first pop song and the number one hit from the album. Every Heartbeat, number two. Every heartbeat bears your name. Loud and clear, they say my claim. Ask anyone and they'll tell you it's true. Every heartbeat belongs to you. Every heartbeat.
Great song.
It was produced by Brown over here. And when I'm giving these numbers, I'm talking about the Billboard Hot 100. These songs also simultaneously have different numbers on Hot AC and Adult Contemporary, where almost every single one of these songs I'm going to mention was either number one record, number two, but definitely in the top five. So June 13th, all that summer, got to dominate the airwaves there, Brown. Well done. That's What Love Is For, produced by Michael. Number seven. Billboard Top 100, September 12th, 1991. Keith, not to be outdone,
right?
You return again 1 year later, January 13th, 1992, with Good For Me. Which goes to number eight.
Yep.
Michael, you're like, hey, I got to follow up, man. So you come in March 31st, 1992 with I Will Remember You, which landed at number 20. Every single song, 5 out of 11 songs, is a top 20 hit.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
That's amazing.
Unusual.
One fun fact there. I don't know if you know that I was part of that song, so we wrote that for the Karate Kid.
Yeah. No.
And got passed on.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you showed them.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
No karate for you.
All of this happens in 1 year and 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now people commit to a big chunk of time for one song, right? It used to be run a song up the charts. It would start working its way down. Before it got halfway down, the label's coming out with another one, right?
Right, right.
And you can almost see that in these dates that I've said. So Baby Baby comes out. It's a worldwide hit record. It comes out in January. Then the album releases in March. And then they hold and wait on Every Heartbeat until the summer.
Yep.
Because they got so much traction on Baby Baby, mm-hmm.
right?
Right. Which brings me to the very, very first question. A&M Records, Gil Friesen, Jerry Moss, Herb Albert, did you know they were going to double down on their commitment to this record at this extent? Were you in on any of that?
I didn't know they were going to double down, but Mike Blanton, one of her two managers, the Eternal Optimist, he knew they were going to double down.
And I think also things were more tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You had success with the result that followed. People go to a store, buy an album, buy a CD. So there's a way to really track what is happening.
Yeah,
it's not just radio, but you've got the consumer is saying, I want that album or I want that record. And I think that's one of the main things. And I think you guys should weigh on this because we're all part of this right now, what's going on. And that is that you, by not having a physical piece or something that you can take home, look at, I think it changes almost everything about the way the record business even functions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that an Amy Grant or name a lot of artists, people would say, hey, if it doesn't work on the first record, we're going to do another one.
Right.
Yeah. We'll do another one.
Right.
We'll do another one. We're committed to this. And you don't have that today.
Yeah.
So I feel sorry for the young artists today because really what they're being judged on is you better make this song good and it better be the one that becomes a hit because mm-hmm. we're not going to really stay committed to you.
Right.
So Amy was at a time where this was a possibility. wasn't an inevitability, but right. it was a possibility. And we were all blessed to be part of that possibility being realized. And so, yeah, I just think it's indicative of the time. And I think we're at another time with all this.
Yeah, it used to be the third album was when you really got the push. It was a little bit different for me because I'd gotten word back that David Annerly wasn't going to single Baby Baby.
That's true.
Wow. So we pulled it. Well, I had gotten Aretha Franklin agreed to record it, Baby Baby, that I also was going to send it to Vanessa Williams. Mm-hmm. And so my assistant, Todd Moore, forgot to put it on the DAT, or the cassette, rather.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, it didn't make it to him. But I think it all worked out.
Whoa.
David says, well, come to L.A. and remix it. So we go out and we mix it with Brian Maloof, actually.
Yeah.
Dropped the tapes off on a Thursday, went back the next day at 3 o'clock, and that was the mix, you know.
Yeah.
So it all worked out for the best, but I'm glad they did give her the push.
What was the promotion guy at A&M, Charlie, he was a huge believer in that song.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I don't know what happened under the table, he got some friends in San Diego and other major stations in California to play that song. And, you know, that's back when phone lines would light up at a radio station.
Full disclosure, when I got the mastering back on that, I played it. I forgot what the next song into that, after Baby Baby on the record. Whatever it was, I felt like mine sucked compared to that. You know, I was so depressed, you know.
No way.
Yes, really? And so I'm driving in the square on Franklin, and that comes on the radio, and I had to pull over. I almost had a panic attack. It was like, this is it. Yeah. This is my first pop hit, you know. It's like, so it was
that
fun.
Was my first multi-producer album to be a part of.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. So I'd always just produced entire records. Yeah. Man, was I ever nervous on this record.
It kind of makes you nervous a little bit. You know, all the guys you respect and love.
Yeah.
My first point of contact was you in this city. You gave me my first, I was like doing background vocals on David Meese with you. Wow. You know, I was like, what? Yeah. You know? Yeah. And then to be producing on a record with you? Come on. Yeah. And this guy. Okay. Yeah. So White Horse.
I lived and breathed
that record.
Well,
you know?
I appreciate that.
So, you know, I'm nervous going in this whole thing with both of you guys.
Right. Like, so was I. Everybody was nervous. I felt intimidated while I was doing the record because I knew I was working with these guys doing their thing.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's healthy, but in a way, it's kind of unhealthy because you don't want to feel like, well, my track has to be better than someone else's track. You don't want to go there.
Right.
That's not even part of what you want to think. But it's just like you said, how anybody could have actually thought Baby Baby wasn't a smash is like, who is that person and why are they in the record business?
Mm.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
The minute you heard the intro, you went, that's radio. There it is. Boom. Bam.
Which David Annerly
was
of that opinion. And I think he's one of the great A&R men.
Yeah, right. No
time.
Question about it.
And that also speaks to the fact that an A&R guy, a radio DJ, can break something locally at that time.
Yeah.
And it can spread like wildfire.
Yeah.
Now everything's corporate. You can't just hand it to a DJ and expect the DJ, whoever she or he is, to be able to break an entire song. You just can't anymore. It's not the way it works. So I think we lived through a very good time, personally.
Amen.
No Even question. As unhealthy as I would say that the record business has always been and dysfunctional, it was much healthier.
Yeah. And it was also at really just 3-4 years into CDs, which we got to say is one of the greatest musical land grabs of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So
of course.
We had that going
for us. Go back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sitting here with three of the greatest record producers in the history of pop music, in my estimation. And as good as they are, there's some special sauce that we have to bring up, and I'll just call it the Amy effect. And love to hear your thoughts on that. Amy just had to walk in a room. Like if she walked in a room with David Annerly and Gil Friesen, right?
Yeah.
Good things were going to happen. So I'd love to hear you talk about that for a minute.
I don't know how far back you want me
to go.
You
go as far back as you want.
Man, I moved to Nashville in 72, fell in love with Jesus.
Yeah.
So when I graduated from school, I moved back up, not thinking I'd be in the music business, but I was a lay youth pastor at Belmont Church.
Yeah.
And her family switched to that church, to Belmont Church. We were on a youth retreat. She brought her guitar because we were singing Kumbaya or something.
Sure.
I don't know. And she said, hey, would you mind just like let me play you some songs. I'd love to record some songs for my great-grandmother's 90th birthday. Mm. And so we sat on two rocks, and she started playing these songs. And I'm like, dang, man, what is it with this girl?
Mm-hmm.
She's immediately mm-hmm. captivating and speaks like an adult, even though she was 14 years old mm. at that time. So that's how far back I go. I helped her make the cassette. I played it for Chris Christian. He picked up the phone, played it for Stan Mosher at Word. Stan said, sign her over yeah. the phone. And he turns to me and says, you want to produce it?
Wow, that's
I'm
so
like,
cool.
I just that's so engineered cool. one record,
yeah. right?
BJ
yeah.
Thomas. I said, I don't know how to produce. He said, you didn't know how to engineer. And we made a gold record and won a Grammy with it.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So I give him credit. But yeah. what's amazing, I did, I guess before that record, like 15 albums with her, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
So we were on quite a journey together.
Yeah.
And I think this is where you guys come in. She always wanted it to be community.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere she went. It didn't matter if she's in a room full of people at our press thing, she's going to like focus in on one person and really connect with them mm-hmm. and build relationship. And she just does that naturally. I think that it's her presence. She truly listens to the room, mm-hmm. to everybody. We all see it from this way and she sees it from this way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I the community that. Thing was really the huge thing.
Yeah. We've all done talent development. And I mean, if you've got two artists of equal talent, right, yeah. sitting in the chair in front of you, you know which one you're going to yeah. choose, right, which is the one that makes your life better and has the least amount of drama, right?
And exactly.
They have a vision for their music and
right.
all of that.
That's right.
And, yeah.
Keith, did you know her well before you did?
Interesting.
You?
I would play keyboards for a group called the Sherritt Brothers, and they had just yeah. gotten signed to Word Records. So we
that's
were
right.
in Waco, Texas, and that's where I found mm. your album, mm. Buddy Huey. You know
yeah.
that name. You won't remember this, but my first time meeting you was at the Gold Mine. Amy was doing vocals. Chris was producing with you there. You mm. were in overalls. He was running around playing fiddle in the room.
Wow.
But that was late night one night at the Gold Mine Studios. Mm. And that's my
that's
first time meeting you.
That's crazy.
It is. That's
yeah.
crazy. And then you brought me in to work on Lead Me On album as a mm-hmm. programmer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where Amy and I kind of developed a relationship. Mm-hmm. And then when I wrote the hook for Baby Baby, I just passed it on to her. She said, oh my God, I love it. Can I write a lyric? And so she did, you know, and that's how that came about.
That's so,
so
cool.
So fascinating, you know?
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah.
Hadn't you already done the Peter Cetera duet with Amy?
I don't know if you know the story, but it's pretty funny.
No.
Give it to us.
Because we had this song that he wanted to do, but he wanted to do it as a duet. And so I forgot what time of the year was, but it would have been a time of the year where anybody he'd call was probably out on the road doing something.
Mm-hmm.
We tried for a couple of days. He was calling different artists and stuff like that, and we weren't getting anywhere. And so I'm sitting there going, well, I know this girl named Amy Grant, and I know of her material. I don't know if I actually had even spent much time with her, mm-hmm. but I was aware of the records. And I just said, off the top of my head, how about Amy Grant? He goes, who? I said, Amy Grant. And he said, oh, I've never heard of her. He says, well, I tell you what, she's going to be at the Forum mm-hmm. this weekend. Sold out two nights at the Forum. And if anybody knows how many people
crazy.
Sit in the Forum, it's ridiculous.
Great card to play.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, that's it.
So I got him tickets.
Yeah.
It was over the weekend, obviously. I get a phone call. He says, man, that's who we've got to have sing. He said, I've never seen so many people. I said, yeah. And then that was the very first time that we were actually in
this funny.
Studio. Yeah, the next
great
time
story.
I fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was great. I mean, she was nervous, took her out of her element
yeah.
and
yeah.
put her into a kind of a foreign situation.
Yeah.
Peter was as gracious as you can get.
Was
yeah.
he?
Very cool. And put her at ease. And that was how I met her. And I was living in L.A. You guys were here, but that was probably one of the first times I actually met her.
What year was that, Michael, when you did that record?
No, it would have been the 80s.
It was 87 or 86.
Yeah, something like 87.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
honestly, that was like the legitimacy that why I even took Blanton's call when I was living in California.
Really?
Because I knew about the duet.
Wow.
He sent me Lead Me On, and then I was like, oh, this is like a real record. Okay, all right.
And some people thought she had lost her salvation because this is the normal way people think. You know, it's like, oh, she did a secular record. How dare, you know, I'm going, boy, oh boy.
Yeah. Michael, you are the pioneer prototype for Keith and I.
Yeah.
You know, we have built our production careers, and Brown to a certain extent, on the idea that we want to be God's musical person everywhere and in everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we're called to it and we're equipped for it and resourced for it, have the skill and ability, we want to be in that room.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that room is conducting the Boston Symphony or playing a jazz gig at Village Vanguard or tracking a pop record in LA, right? We don't want anybody saying, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. Right.
Right. You know, we have personal reasons for it, but it's also can be deeply theological reasons for it, right? We literally want to be God's musical person as many places as we can. But it's been an uphill battle. But you truly were, in my mind, a pioneer for that because, as Keith said, he was talking about listening to your solo records, right?
Yeah.
You were serving the church, in other words, making the music of the church and making music that was pop music that could have been for the church or anyone who wanted to listen.
Yeah.
And then you were also playing keyboards on all these different records, huge records that are considered classics today, and then having this amazing production career as well.
Mm.
So that set the standard, I think, the basis for people like us to come along and say, oh, we really can. We don't have to be pigeonholed in this one thing. We can do that. But it was an uphill climb. And for someone like Amy, who had done, like, what do we say, like 14 records, right, that were very inside, then the single comes out, and then Lead Me On is like one step further. It starts to be these songs that the narrative is widening.
Mm-hmm.
It's still very much from a person of faith, but the narrative, the lyric is getting bigger and wider and more invitational to everyone come in. Everyone come in and listen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then by Heart and Motion, like she told me, she said, I want to make a record that's fun. Because when we have family gatherings, put on Motown, we dance around and all that, I want to enter into that. Yeah. Now I want to make one of those records that people dance around.
Sure.
Many people that profess to be Christians, they were not happy with that. And yet we're talking about it like 30 plus years later. It'd be really hard for some young listeners to even like grasp like how people would say, well, that's just ridiculous. You know,
drums were a big
devil. I think we were saying it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I remember years and years ago, Billy Ray Hearn telling me, it's like, you're fighting your fight.
Yeah.
I had to fight just so an electric guitar could be in a sanctuary.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Or a drum set.
Yeah, or a drum set.
Yeah.
I mean, you made this beautiful, amazing pop record that it was like you were making the songs the whole world sings, and yet many of your brothers and sisters thought you and Amy had committed this great crime against Jesus.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, against the church.
Well, knowing her, it's their problem.
Right.
That's simply put. I remember being almost assaulted for sitting at a drum set in a Christian school in Oklahoma back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And someone came up and started screaming at me for sitting at a drum set. I'm going, what did I do? I mean, I love the Beatles. I mean, I came from Chicago. I mean, what is this? And I'm going, what are you getting mad at me for? So my attitude was, I doubt that Jesus would be miffed by any of this.
Right.
There were bigger issues than someone sitting at a drum set, or someone plugging in a guitar. And I think Amy was so gracious about it. That's what I loved about her. And it's interesting because she was very aware there were people that were very, very upset. And yet when you talk to her, it was just incredible how her countenance wasn't that changed. It was like you could have 1,000 people against me, and she was still positive.
You could not get
smiling.
Her to dish negative.
It was hard to get a negative out of her. You'd almost have to say, well, let me make the statement on your behalf.
You agree or not.
Yeah. I mean, please. So anyway.
Wow. Yeah, I was producing an artist at the time that you would think we'd have killed somebody.
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
it was that bad. You know? But like Michael says, you have to know her. Any negative comments about her, you just don't know this lady. This woman is as solid as they come. I have watched her walk into a room that everybody knows Amy Grant, But she will make a point to introduce herself. Hi, I'm Amy Grant, as if we don't know. But she's that personable, you know? And it's just to have anything negative to say about this woman just means you don't know her.
That's right.
That's just it.
I don't want you guys to gang up on me, but I think it's kind of ironic that we have two guys who have come up with some of the greatest, hookiest keyboard intros in the world. In Michael's time, it might have been da-da-da. Da, 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 right? Yeah. So two eighth notes
Get
followed by
here.
A quarter note, right? And then what did you do? There's a little derivation of that. I love it.
I've like learned from him. That's
development. We're going to start with Baby Baby.
Well, amen.
Yeah. Talk to us about the track. What was going on in your head?
And I had this little studio set up in the basement of my home in Franklin and just started playing this keyboard hook, you know?
Yep.
Put this track together. I had Brian Tankersley, who has since passed. Yep. God bless him. One of my best friends. He was there with me and we were doing drums and stuff. And I don't know if you've ever worked with Brian, but oh my, he's like a scientist. He was measuring the kick and the snare, how far apart they were. That's how technical he was at the time. I programmed Baby Baby on the Mac Plus.
Yeah, 28K.
I know, right? I brought it to the studio with Amy. This was, we were working on something and we pulled it up. And sure enough, the first thing that popped up was Baby Baby on the screen.
No way.
It's and it's pretty fascinating to see.
Were you recording to a floppy disk?
Yes.
Oh, that's funny.
But yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. You were working on that.
I know, right?
Well, yeah, we used to call it programming, you know, because it was that close to computer programming, and we all had computers in the beginning. Programming is beat making.
Yeah.
We were doing it 40 years ago, but it was called programming then. We were making beats, and you essentially, you made a beat. You had this keyboard riff,
keyboard
this
hook.
Thing that you fell in love with. You love this hook.
I typically write that way, though. I will write a hook, and then lyrically, I'll do a hook, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'll finish it out melodically, note for note, and hand it over to a lyricist.
You told us that Amy wrote the lyrics to it, and then who else played on it?
Donald McElroy and Ron Hemby sang background. The track is pretty much me, because it's got synth bass and keys and stuff, so I did all of that.
I looked at the credits this morning, and everything was you,
except
for vocals.
Background vocals,
yeah.
And we did those out at the Bennett House, which was fun.
Well, that was the beauty of the time. I mean, one of the reasons why I wasn't a very good record producer in the beginning is because I was so fascinated of hearing my own musical mind finally out in the open and the ability to sort of do all those things, right? And, you know, you have that moment of where you're pretty enthralled with yourself.
Right, Oh, I can do this.
Yeah. Right. And then you have to learn, like, hey, just because you could do that, it doesn't equate artistry. You might actually want to have an actual bass player or guitar player.
Exactly.
Or
So
you learn to mix and match and all of that. But in the beginning, that was one of the fascinations of it. It's like you could literally hear your dream now in your head, like, and get it out quickly without having a tracking session,
right?
You can have it. And that was the beauty of it. That completed that track. And then you weren't getting the love that you wanted. And so you started pitching it around to some other folks.
We'd gotten Aretha degree to cut it. And then we were going to stick it on this cassette that's going to Vanessa.
Yeah.
And got left off. And it was all meant to be.
That was post your huge hit with Vanessa Williams?
No, it was prior to that.
That was prior to that. Okay.
Yeah, because that Baby Baby is what really flung open the doors for you. Because you were
also...
That was
my first pop hit,
You were also nominated for Producer of the Year.
Right.
That had to be on that record.
It was the tip of the spear.
It had to be.
It opened up everything
else. Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have been the same thing without that leading it off.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was fun. So much fun.
You next... Number two.
Oh, my gosh.
Brian Adams would not budge out of that number one spot, man.
Everything I Do from Robin Hood, right?
Oh, really?
I mean, he was there for, he was number one for 12 weeks.
He was super irritating.
Super irritating. Yeah, I still have a bone to pick with him.
28 straight days of mixing on that one song.
Is that Bob Clearmountain?
Yeah, with Brian Adams.
Crazy.
I was in the next room while they were doing it. They'd rip the whole board down and do it again and do it again.
Wow.
And I'm going, what do you want to hear?
I mean,
the progression, you know, I'd worked with Chris and Tommy and Gordon on Freedom. And then Peter asked me to come out of AC pop music and work with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you came to Nashville and we did.
So you put your career on the line for me.
So got to work with you. That hit record, Secret of Time, which was an amazing experience. We were cutting at Quad Studios, and that studio with the Neve console, just so dead. So we put Chris McHugh out in the refreshment room. He got hot, opened up the door. and somebody called the police on us for disturbing the peace.
Nice.
They said, stop doing that take, and we moved everything out to the Bennett House. And Charlie said after that, man, we should have gotten arrested. That would have been great press.
Great press, right. Arrested.
I love that.
No, I told him, I said, like, think about how much his cred would have gone up to get arrested.
Right? Totally.
Hey, people are like, oh, yeah, mild-mannered Brown. And then it'd be like, no, dude.
No, he was in jail.
I did 5 years, recording drums.
Anyway, so I got to work with Charlie on that record, and you were a little edgy of a...
Yeah.
I wanted to see if they could reel me in enough to make something that might have
something
some return.
Sell. And so I was kind of the safety net in that game. But as we started going down the path on that record, and you were doing all this programming and demos and stuff, I'm like, who's producing who? This guy. You know, I mean, I realized just kind of the potential of what was inside of you. I'm sure I asked you if you had any songs to pitch to Amy for this Motion record, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's how it worked. And you had this melody. And
I went and put something together. Yeah.
Oh, is that what happened?
Oh, of course.
Oh, you didn't have it sitting there.
No.
And anyway, I mean,
Was that McHugh playing drums on that one?
It is.
Yes, McHugh, Tommy.
Was McPherson playing guitar? Who was playing guitar on that one?
McPherson, I think.
What did you use when you used the guitar?
McPherson and Huff both,
yeah,
as much as I could.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Michael, you came up with some of the greatest session musicians of all time. Of course, you know, you've been in Nashville now for, 30 years?
Just a little bit more.
The musicians that are on Heart in Motion, if you go and look at that list now,
that's pretty impressive.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I know that for me, what I admired about, especially with what I knew of Keith, was his musicality when it came to the art of programming.
Yes.
I came from pre-programming.
Yeah.
The only thing I ever had was a Mini Moog and an ARP 2600. And so I was just used to going into a studio with either four or five cats.
Yeah.
And recording a track.
Yeah.
And so as this movement started taking place, there were a few people that I looked to that I go, that's very musical. And I strive for that, but it would frustrate me because I always thought the solution for me is just to get and play something. But I knew that the sounds were changing. Everything was changing. And one of the reasons why I actually left LA to come here was because there was still a lot of live recording. I always felt more comfortable falling back on piano, Rhodes, whatever.
Right.
I always had such an admiration, and I don't know if I've told you this, but I've always admired your programming almost more than anybody else's because it has such an organic yet cool consistency to it. That's a combination of being very musical and using this what's available to you and not abusing that art. And I've always felt that way. Actually, felt a little bit intimidated during those days because I'm going, I'm trying to learn this, but I don't feel like I've got it inside of me to do what you're doing. And I would always get myself very frustrated because it was easier for me to just sit down at a piano and write something at a piano.
Yeah.
I'd try to put up a beat and I'd go, I'd feel confined where it would be releasing to some people.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go, this is so frustrating to me. It shouldn't be frustrating, but it is. And even though that I felt like I got more comfortable as time went on, it was a slow process for me. Very slow. We were talking about that second arrangement thing, that Steely Dan thing. I get excited when someone says, I want to put piano on something. I go, I get to play piano on something.
Yeah.
Or I get to write strings and stuff like that. I'm still that old soul.
Yeah.
But I love really good programmed if it's really done well.
Yeah.
And it has to be done by people who really know what the heck they're doing. And I can't say that for a lot of what I hear.
So the songs you produced on Heart in Motion,
did
you program the drums?
Yeah, I struggled.
So that's all programmed.
Yeah. I would put up a beat on an Alesis or whatever.
Yeah.
That's what Love's for. We had a guy named Dave Raven that played drums.
Yeah.
But we did it in pieces.
Yeah.
We didn't cut that all live. things were getting really different. It was not going into the studio with four or five guys anymore.
Yeah, well, you couldn't have flams anymore, and you couldn't have, I mean, you had to, like, yeah, you had to like be you said, tight.
Tankersley, you know, measuring bass drum. But no, I did a lot of programming.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of live stuff. In other words, a lot of those synthesizers you're hearing were not going through a computer. I was just playing. Yeah.
You weren't sequencing. Sure. You were playing.
I was playing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the technology is unbelievable.
Right.
But there's music still has to be there.
Yeah.
No vocal tuning at that time?
Nope.
No, we did not have vocal tuning.
So, I mean, you listen to the vocals on that record, man. They're awesome.
And I don't remember spending a whole lot of time with her. You worked her, didn't you?
I don't think she ever worked as she did on Baby.
Okay, so we have one great producer who says, we didn't spend a lot of time. We have two guys that, well, let's just say they've never seen a vocal that it didn't look like an opportunity for perfection.
Well, yeah.
Tell our audience a little bit what's going on. Like, why are you able to say, man, that's great, we're done? And then why are you two guys able to say, that's really, really good, but it can still be better?
One more time.
Yeah.
One more time.
One more time.
That's always it.
Yeah.
I thought vocal comping was fun and kind of an art form.
Yeah.
So for me, I would let her sing seven or eight times and I'd say, see ya.
Yeah.
And I had a special box that a guy made for me.
Comp box?
A comp box.
Was it Jay Graydon's box?
It was based on that.
With the slider?
It was eight-track sliders.
Yeah.
And I had fun with that. Now, that didn't mean we didn't bring her back in. And everybody has their own system of doing things. I enjoyed the idea of get a bunch of vocals done, and then if we need to correct something when you come in, you correct it.
And how about you, Keith?
We'd do verse by verse, chorus, whatever. Yeah. And I would have her sing it in different inflections. You know, give me your British approach. Or
that's cool.
Yeah, so there's different things that I wanted her to do. I can't remember. She was one of them. I would used to put a pencil in somebody's mouth and have them sing or whatever. Yeah. But she was a trooper. I mean, she would stand in that booth
She'd sing forever
and never complain, ever, you know?
I think to me that's like the greats are always like that. They're either like never complain or they just come out and say like it's never going to get better than that. That's it. That's it for me.
Yeah.
It's like Al Green told us. If you want to hear it again, you'll have to sing it yourself.
or go buy the record.
And some people were like that, man.
I've had a few of those myself.
I'm done. No, you're not done.
I was just about trying to create something. She could have gone in and sang it fine the first time and been fine. But we were creating art, you know?
Yeah.
You never know what you're
I think that's cool.
And you were helping her grow
as
a singer. And
You stretched her like she had not been stretched.
Yeah.
That just blew my mind when I heard her vocal on that. But also, Keith is a fantastic singer.
Yeah. Mm.
And you got her to sing licks and things that she had never done before, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she did stretch it there.
So you were able to pull things and pull her into a world that she had never been in and never would have gotten there with me.
Well, that's not true.
Because your sense of melody and melody architecture and all of that.
You know, our generational mix here is we're blended. We have some overlaps and whatnot. I have this theory that we kind of have our peak moment of being a person of our time.
Yep.
Like where you just hear the music of your time. And that's kind of like usually when you're really, the sparks are really flying. Oh, and I think that's probably what you brought to her was that you were so in tune of the music of the time that you were able to bring her into that. And I would say that's one of the reasons why that is a, you know, such a smash hit too.
And the modulation. Come on, man. Can I interject something?
Sure.
The other thing about Every Heartbeat is this is not really in me. You guys have it like the soul thing, but you've got this soul thing in terms of how you feel things, sing a melody, the bridge on that song. And I just have to say that was a hit. It's great. It's my only number two hit in all of pop music in my whole career. So thank you for that. But you were very involved in that whole production, and I feel kind of guilty I didn't give you points on that, you know? Like,
we can always remedy that.
We can change that right now.
Okay.
Yeah, retroactively.
No, but we can fix that. I'm telling the listener that these guys are like...
We all do that, though.
But when you're good buddies.
Hey, I was so grateful, Brown. I was so grateful to be working and to be working with such high caliber musicians. I mean, it was my dream to be around musicians that were as good as the ones I was working with and be working with you. I learned so much. I thought I had a pretty exacting attention to detail until I met you.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I learned, no, there's a whole another level. I felt like I entered into a real season that was so aspirational and like so
Since we're inspiring. Talking about Heart in Motion and the hits, I just want to tip my hat to you because I think you were a huge part.
Thanks. Well, you let me program.
You worked the horn arrangements.
Yeah. Everything. Yeah.
Yep. All of us have all these incredible musicians that work with us. For me to take credit for any of all that stuff, I just can't do it because you got like guys like Dan Huff and Tommy Sims and McPherson and all those guys, you know, made such a huge contribution. Billy Whittington. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, gosh.
Billy was my guy for two decades.
That's right.
Yeah. Tommy and I were talking a couple months ago and it just came to me. I was like, yeah, Brown was like our Miles Davis.
Yeah.
You know, he just came out and he got all these people and like gave us the opportunity, you know, to shine. And then it was like from that moment on, then we were like, we were doing it.
Right.
I appreciate it.
When I think of Amy, there isn't one even quasi negative thing that goes through my mind ever. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that about everybody that I've worked with. No. But with her, I just there's nothing that I look to and I go, she was just such a magnificent human being and modeling Christ in every way.
Absolutely.
And it was a pleasure to work on that project with her. I was in L.A. when that was going on.
Yeah.
So the contrast when I'd fly out here or she would come out there or whatever, it was astounding.
Yeah.
That was really a fun project. I'll never forget, we all went to New York and she was up for the Grammy and all that kind of stuff. I was so excited for her to be in that position because I felt she really deserved it. So,
oh, of course. Anyway. When I first went out to play her the song at her house, I'd never been out there before, come in the gate and go down that long tree-lined drive right down to the house and I'm like, man, I am so out of my element here.
Oh.
I got out of the Doge, went in the house, and there was Amy, and she greeted me and gave me a big hug. And I felt so safe and so at home. Mm-hmm. And then we just talked music, and I left her the songs. We listened to them. She gave me a book, In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do? By Charles Sheldon. Yep. It was an old book written in like 1898, and she was really into that book. Yeah. That time, and she had a whole stack of them sitting on her desk.
To give away.
And I just imagine like she would just give them to whoever would come. And I remember going right home and reading that book because it was kind of like if Amy Grant gave me this book, I'm going to read
it. You're going to go read it,
That's such a great illustration of her. I mean, that's what you see with Amy, working with her, making music with her, being friends with her, observing her in our community. She truly is in his steps. No question about it. The last thing I was just going to mention was that fast forwarding all these years, how cool was that 45th Kennedy Center Honors 2022, George Clooney,
you
Gladys
too.
Knight, you two, and Amy Grant, and hearing those songs, being a part of that moment. And I know you got to go, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you were there. That was cool.
You were there.
And Keith, that's you cool. went.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, she deserves that. And I was just in tears. I mean, you know, it's like, I cried the drop of a hat anyway, but it's like my girl's up there on stage getting this award.
Yeah,
you know,
that's awesome.
And then being escorted into the Oval Office and taking a pic with the president.
That was surreal, wasn't
You've probably done that many times.
I think that we've all made a lot of hit records at this point and had the accolades and rung the cash register and heard the sound of applause. But at the end of the day, you know, when you work on a record like Heart in Motion and you have those songs and you have the memories and you have the community of Nashville, Michael, you coming into the community and you and Stormy finding a home here.
Yeah.
And it just becomes such a seamlessly integrated story. And then it's just not over. It's like then the Kennedy Center honors happen and you just see like, you know what? Thank you, Lord.
Okay.
I got to participate in something that is actually bigger than the sum of those hit records.
Absolutely.
It's this literally stepping into a story of God's musical people across time.
I agree with that.
And thank you guys for being here.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Telling you stories.
It's good to see my buddies here.
I know.
It's been a while.
I know.
It's been a while.
It's really great. I feel like I should close by giving you props, Michael, because you're actually in my book. I don't know if you remember this, but years ago, Brown and I were at your house for a dinner party. And I told you the story of how a record that you had produced on a friend of mine from Sacramento, and that I was the keyboard player that was hired to play your keyboard parts.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And at the time, let's just say, I was kind of trying to do my own thing. I thought Michael Martin was pretty great. I kind of thought I was pretty great, too. Sure. And you had written out these immaculate charts. And the artist's name, as you know, is Roger Vadouris, right?
Oh, my gosh.
And you had a hit with him on it.
Yeah.
And I was going to be the keyboard player on tour.
Oh,
right?
My gosh.
And I was, like, playing the chords, and I'm like, I don't know, G11, it sounds okay, but it's like, there's all these alternate bass, you know, it's like, what if this one's pure and this one isn't, and I just like it. And Roger's like, no, man, you got to play Michael's parts. And I was just thinking to myself, yeah, I really wish I could.
Oh, that's funny.
But anyway, so then we're there. I tell you this story. You were so gracious, and I was just delighted to meet and hang out with one of my heroes. And you had this beautiful grand piano there in the living room. I think I probably walked over and hit a chord or something, and you said, yeah, Yamaha gave me that. I've got another one downstairs in the studio, right? And the thought that came into my head was, if Yamaha would give Michael Amardian two pianos, maybe they'd give me a half of one.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Spin it.
And you lovingly and graciously called your rep at Yamaha, and they gave me a half a piano.
Oh, I love that.
So thank you for that.
Yamaha for me. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, thank you for that.
I'm just kidding. I'll just add one thing to that. I remember vividly sitting in my apartment on my Fender Rhodes, working through Steely Dan, trying to figure out those chords and slamming my hands on the keyboard because it was like so difficult, those changes, you know?
Yeah.
And then to finally get to work with him and meet with him. Oh, it's
I appreciate
it. It doesn't get better than
it does.
You know, it just, when you find your people and you find where the bar is set, you know,
that's it.
And then you are able to, through encouragement and love and just seeing it done.
Yeah.
You know?
All right.
Yep.
It is a good life.
We've all been blessed.
Definitely been blessed.
We really have been.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's go make some more music.
Absolutely.
Yep. Let's do it.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Music and Meaning with Charlie Peacock, a CT Media original podcast. Before we close, a respectful shout out to Michael Blanton, Dan Harrell, and John Huey, who deftly guided Amy and Heart in Motion through this remarkable sentence in the long book of pop music history, and to Jennifer Cook, who continues to steward the story today. Avail yourself of my latest book, a collab with my wife, Andy, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much, The Way of Love in a World of Hurt. Available everywhere. Goodness and peace to you.